Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Computer Vision in Production podcast show, the podcast show where we talk all about everything computer vision, from the individual components of the technology, including vision, cameras, and deep learning, right through to hearing about some of the most interesting applications that companies are using at the moment. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Soda AI Computer Vision in Production podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly. Today's guest is Antonio Freire Toyson. Antonio is a good friend of mine. We've met a couple of times. He spoke at a couple of meetups that I've hosted before. So it's great to finally have him here on one of my podcast shows. When I mean here, I mean both of us are working from home. It's 2020, so everyone's working from home. So for those who don't know Antonio, he is one of the founders of the Computer Vision Meetup for Berlin. He's a senior data scientist at Neurotrain, previously worked at Home2Go, and he has a background in medical imaging. Antonio, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Anthony. It's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Yes, no, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, so Antonio, look, I gave a very initially brief introduction to yourself. No better person to introduce yourself than you. So why don't you give us a little bit of an introduction of your background, what got you into computer vision, where and what you've done to bring you to where you are today?
Well, I'm a computer scientist. I studied a licentiate degree in computer science in Venezuela. Then I did a master's degree in biomedical computer vision. And well, it was during my studies that I got into computer vision. I started working in the field doing segmentation of brain tumors for magnetic resonance imaging. This is something that people do to plan radiosurgical treatments. And I did both my licentiate degree thesis and my master's degree thesis on methods, segmentation of brain tumors. I used cellular automata for doing this and variations of cellular automata. I created a method called irregular growth cut that takes the cellular automaton rule, makes it run within a network so that we can get segmentations that are assisted. That means that they are guided by an expert, by a neurosurgeon, but they're highly reproducible and they're very precise and very sensitive. So this method allows neurosurgeons to have more transparency in the way that they are planning a radiosurgical treatment. One thing that is commonly done in this field is that people draw contours of what is a tumor. They mark what is healthy tissue, like in every slide of a magnetic resonance study. And this is like time consuming and also has like variability between different neurosurgeons, because different neurosurgeons draw the same tumor with different contours. And even the same surgeon, if you show him like the exact same tumor, he might draw different things on different days. So the idea for this project was to make the segmentation completely deterministic and completely reproducible so that we could have a way to have more accountability about the process, because this is something very delicate. You know, radiation is getting fired to the brain of people, and it's very important to make this as precise as possible and not to harm the patient, not to destroy any healthy brain. So that was something that I initially did with the growth cut cellular automaton, which is a very interesting rule-based method that allows you to get some very precise and very sensitive segmentations. So I was studying ways to create initial states, to create like very good segmentations with very little intervention, like how to create unsupervised segmentations with the cellular automaton, and then how to fine tune the segmentations. That is when I started running the cellular automaton into a network so that these segments that were initially discovered by the automaton could be grouped together. It was a way for the neurosurgeon to play with the segmentation as if it were like a puzzle piece, saying, okay, I want like these two pieces of the puzzle that have a high probability of being tumor to have an even higher certainty of being tumor. And these things that are edema, that are like fluid, okay, I want them to be marked with higher certainty for edema. It was successful. Well, I got some very nice results in a very public data set, the BRAT segmentation data set. And I got my master's degree doing that thing.
Nice. Look, before we go on to anything further, I suppose just one thing I'd like to ask about particular experience on the segmentation of tumors. You know, advancements in technology now are a little bit faster, a little bit further on than when they were when you were completing your research. Like, I suppose if you were to look at it now and try to productionize this type of code, this type of algorithm, how would you look at it? Because I know now you've got to have an explainable AI, which is quite big. Do you think that will become quite challenging? Or how would you look to make it explainable? Because I guess it's very, if you're a computer scientist, it's very jargony towards the medical industry, right? It's going to have a lot of that. You probably need a lot of help from doctors and so on to even write reports about what it can do and specifics of what it can't do.
Yeah, definitely. And explainability is a big issue for AI. This particular project is something that's very compatible with current segmentation methods like UNET and MassGuard-CNN. I have seen people who are now combining the output of segmentations from MassGuard-CNN and from UNET with a girl called Solar Automaton, like I did to refine the segmentation. This is something that I saw a paper from last year where people were doing this, and I thought it was pretty cool. I actually thought about running this a couple of times, but never got the chance and never wrote the paper, so somebody else did it. I was happy to see it published, you know, because it's a very good way to fine-tune these segmentations. This method that I was talking about, the Solar Automaton, is actually one that has very high explainability because it allows you to see how does the segmentation evolve step by step. The Solar Automaton is a rule-based process that works iteratively, so you're able to see how from an initial state the segmentation is evolving, and you can even modify it on any given step. So if you see that something is evolving in a way that it's incorrect, you can fine-tune the seeds, and that way you get like higher quality segmentation. When I was working on this thing, I was aware that deep learning could have given me good results, even though fully convolutional networks were just appearing at the time. But I wanted to make the process as interpretable as possible. And it turns out that using a Solar Automaton is way more interpretable than using a deep learning method like UNET or MassGuard-CNN. But you can pair them together. The cool thing is that you can pair the output of a MassGuard-CNN algorithm or a UNET with a girl code as a second step. And that gives you very high quality segmentation.
Excellent. And then straight from your research, you kind of went in, CTO'd and founded a company in Venezuela called The Chain. Tell us a little bit about that and what you were working on there.
Well, I started that company with a couple of colleagues from my university, my own students. I actually hired a couple of brilliant students, and we started doing projects on artificial intelligence and also blockchain. We did something that I'm particularly enthused about, is that we put medical records into the IPFS system, the Interplanetary File System, and then we secure the access to these records using the Hyperledger Fabric blockchain. So this is something that we developed as an open source project, and it's freely available. You can go to the website of The Chain, and you will see it's thechain.tech. It's www.thechain.tech. And you'll see a link to AirMed Foundation. This is the name of this particular project, and it's freely available with an open source license. I think we use Affero GPL v3. So that means that anybody can use this and replicate it They can set up their own servers for storing medical records.
And so from the chain, you then began your flip to Central Europe and started working with Home2Go.
Yeah.
That was kind of, I suppose, look, not to say that your other positions weren't industry focused, but the capabilities of what you were doing with computer vision were very much project focused, for one, as opposed to being medical or medical imaging related.
So yeah.
What was the big difference between working on medical images versus working on, I suppose, images of hotel rooms?
Well, to be honest, my passion is biomedical imaging. So I went into working into images of hotel rooms and this sort of thing as a step. This was a stepping stone for me to get into Europe. I appreciate the opportunity that Home2Go gave me. I enjoyed working on those particular projects. This was actually a job that I took just to come here to Germany. As many people might have heard, many of the people who are listening to this podcast are aware of the situation in my home country. It's chaotic. It's a complete mess. So to be honest, I came here practically like an economic migrant. You know, I was very happy with my job and with my post at the university in Venezuela, but I came to Europe mainly because of the political and economical situation in Venezuela. So Home2Go gave me some very interesting opportunities. I work on only computer vision topics. I work on image similarity, image classification, image quality enhancement, object detection. These were topics that allowed me to further my practice on deep learning. It was interesting for me to deploy methods on, you know, a catalog that had so many images. You know, Home2Go has the biggest catalog of vacation rentals images in the world. We had 70 million offers. It was, I think, 500 million unique images. We deployed classifiers for telling whether images were bedrooms or bathrooms, or whether they had balconies and whether they had sky views and things like this that allowed us to better selection of the offer cards, and also being able to personalize the things that we show to different users. So this step of understanding the inventory of Home2Go was very important for business. And we also did something that was interesting for us to understand the inventory. We did image matching using deep learning. We took the activations of networks like ResNets, and we took like these activations to evaluate the similarity of images. And when they were above a certain threshold, we declared them as duplicates. This was interesting for Home2Go because we get like so varied metadata from different vacation rental providers that we need to be able to compare whether two offers are the same by just looking at the images. You know, we found that the most reliable way to compare whether two offer cards were referring to the same physical thing was comparing the images that we have of the objects, right? So we took like the activations of a ResNet to get like this classifier that would say whether things are duplicates or non-duplicates, and it worked awesomely. We were able to, you know, make like all the crop and zoom images that we had in the search results disappear. And this is something that is a very simple method and it's super powerful.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind, but even looking back on the presentation you've done, like some of these duplicates or some of these proposed duplicates were so similar that even I would have to look at the image two or three times to think that that's not even the same room. Could be using the same bed lining, same curtains, but little things like the window is like longer than it is in one picture and the pillows are different. But other than that, it looks like the exact same room.
Yeah, it's amazing that we're able to do this with deep learning because these kind of things, like 15 years ago, have taken a lot of feature engineering. And I even tried a couple of feature engineering methods, like based on key point matching, because a previous data scientist had worked on this at HomeToGo. And it didn't give as good results as this simple method based on the cosine similarity of the activations of a ResNet. So that was pretty nice, and I was pretty happy with the result of that project.
No, that's really good, really good. And then, so that kind of takes you up to NeuralTrain. So what's kind of the team and the team's goal there at NeuralTrain?
We're currently building a treatment for depression. I cannot give you much details about the product because it's all protected by an NDA.
R&D as well, right? I mean, until it's very clear what you're doing, you can't have the competition known either, right?
Yeah. I shouldn't talk about it. I can tell you that we are a very small team. We're only 7 people. And currently the engineering team is just me and a friend, Victor Hernandez, who is a data engineer. We are building, well, I cannot tell you what we're building. We're working with this team of neuroscientists and psychologists. And we're currently funded by the German government and also by private investors. And NeuralTrain is a company that works within the incubator system of Flying Health.
Okay, cool. So I suppose if we start and move back more towards like computer vision, and we talk about sort of the topics that you've worked on in the past. So you've, the business aspect side of things is kind of the word you use, and it's actually a better word than what I was thinking, because it's not that medical imaging isn't business focused. It's just, it's a completely different type of way of using data. You know, you've got to present it to customers as opposed to stakeholders in most cases, being the big one. So when it came to sort of the topics that you were working on in Home2Go, you mentioned, you know, duplicates and stuff like that, but at a very early stage, I think when you came in there wasn't much computer vision going on at all. Am I right?
Yeah, there was nobody working full-time on computer vision. They had a couple of algorithms that were implemented. Like, for example, this thing that we solve using the cosine similarity. I remember that it was first solved using the perceptual hashing algorithm. Things that the perceptual hashing algorithm did not solve these cases of zoom and crop images. So that's actually the reason why they hired me. And they wanted also to solve more of their problems with understanding inventory. So yeah, when I came to Home2Go, I was the first data scientist working solely on images.
Okay. So look, from an early stage, they had something that in there algorithm-wise, but I suppose, look, we both know if you give a machine learning engineer an opportunity to throw in an algorithm, they kind of just fix up a quick black box, throw a couple of algorithms together, put something in without... You could probably weren't even able to go back and look at the logic behind these algorithms. Look, I'm not saying you couldn't, but I'm saying the chances are like that's probably what it looked like. Would I be right?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Oh, I was saying, so when you started at Home2Go, you mentioned there was a couple of algorithms in play for computer vision, but I suppose when you have machine learning engineers and they get given the opportunity, they just release and push out algorithms and code, and the quality aspect of it, of computer vision, probably wouldn't have been there. I suppose when you go back to early stage, like data annotations, data quality, analytics behind the data that was actually being used for that algorithm.
It does require a different mindset. It requires more of an openness with experimenting different approaches. And actually patience and some tolerance towards failure that it's sometimes not present in software teams. You know, software development teams just want to ship things right away. So they just want to get the problem solved. And this makes complete sense from a business perspective. You know, it's like management doesn't really care about which algorithm we're using to solve a particular problem. They just care about getting the problem solved.
Yeah.
And so that makes complete business sense. And it's something that we also have to deal with as data scientists. You know, there's always this compromise between quality and time. We cannot explore the whole space of possible solutions. We need to narrow our search. We need to hone in on the things that we think have a higher chance of success to deliver solutions on time.
Yeah. So that kind of takes us in. You have to come in and do what I'm trying to get at is for someone out there who might have to come in and work in a similar environment, which most companies would have something there if they're not a pure computer vision company, or even if they're starting a new computer vision product or project. What would you recommend now that you've done it? What would you recommend doing, and what processes would you follow to sort of introduce a fresh sort of computer vision of what it should look like?
Something that we work quite a lot on to go was developing a calibration set, a data set that would allow us to benchmark our results, because this is something very important in order to convey results to management and to convey process. So if I were to give advice to somebody who is trying to bring a computer vision project into being in a business setting, I would advise them to focus on the metrics, to focus on the things that you can measure so that you can report to management the progress that you're making on your particular project. Because if you cannot measure what you're working on, and if you cannot explain it clearly, and if you cannot align your metrics with the business need, then you're not going to get faith from your team, and you're not going to get faith and support from management. So this is critical. I think this is probably the most important thing to do in business settings, which is build trust through evidence and through numerical evidence that you can report quite clearly.
Yeah. And I suppose for early stage KPIs, what would you be looking at? Would you be setting KPIs around data quality, data annotation? You know, you could have 10,000 images. You might only be able to use 1,000. That's obviously going to impact the speed of what work you're going to be able to deliver. And then even when you're building or looking to intake in future data, you could be discrediting 90% of it. So, are you looking to completely reshape everything and put these, as I said, KPIs behind them that can be easily followed and easily understood to the rest of the business?
Yeah, well, data quality is a real issue, and there's always a trade-off between the time that you need to invest in order to clean your data and providing a solution to the particular problem. The thing is that having high data quality allows you to think clearly, more clearly about your particular problem. And it allows you to benchmark the way that you're progressing in a way that builds trust. So I emphasize in my particular workflows, I emphasize the importance of data quality and the importance of collection of enough data and with enough statistical power in order to make inferences about what are we going to achieve with this particular data set for this particular problem. So yeah, data quality is something that people need to focus a lot on. Currently, there has been this interest on this topic called active learning, which is using computer vision models, machine learning models, in order to iteratively improve a data set, like seeing where things are being misclassified the most, and then take this high error items and send them back to human labelers, and to keep this doing as a process. This is very important for industrial applications, because you want to be able to fine-tune the performance of your model on poor data and also higher quality data. And doing this iteratively, increasing relabelings, allows you to actually understand the importance of your data quality better.
Yeah. Now, I suppose this is one thing, I'm not sure if it's I always bring up this topic, so anyone who listens will probably have heard me say it before, but interested to get your take on it. In the USA, a lot of companies actually have data annotation engineers, kind of like the same way a data engineer would fit into a data science team. A data annotation engineer would sit into a team with computer vision professionals and annotate the data as at a professional level. Is that, obviously it's not something a startup company could do, but do you think that's going to be something we'll probably see more of in the future?
Yeah, definitely. I do think that startups have a space for this type of role. Even at Home2Go, we had a huge amount of people, like working students, relabeling images.
Yeah.
And this is something that you can actually, instead of having a team of 10 or 20 working students, you can have maybe one or two of these data annotation engineers who will be able to do work that it's actually better coordinated. Like you see resources like Amazon Mechanical Turk or things like the labeling service that Google Cloud has. It escapes my mind, its name at the moment, allows you to do these active learning workflows in a way that it's more time and cost efficient.
So yeah, that was going to take me on to the next one. If there was investment into data annotation engineers, and I suppose the role was more higher regarded within a company, you know, you could get someone who could build an internal annotation tool that could even annotate data real time 99% of the time, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah, actually, I would say that what's important is for people who have a good understanding of the business problem to be able to check the output of the computer vision model and to help to fine tune it, you know? So having data annotation engineers, I think, is a good investment for a part of startups. And I think we'll see more people working in this particular role in the next years.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, we've just mentioned you want to come in, relook at business process, relook at data quality and annotation pipelines. So you have your basis, that's your foundations of where you're going to build actual data science and computer vision models from. What's the next steps from here before you even start looking at object detection or image classification? You start researching technologies or use cases? Where do you go?
Well, the use case is the most important question. Like, what is the problem that we're trying to solve and how big is the problem? Because sometimes a problem is not so big for a particular business that we can ignore it. And even if we have method, an algorithmic method that can solve it, the time investment, it's probably not worth it. It's in business settings, it's always crucial to think about these things from the stakeholder's perspective. So the problem that we're trying to solve and the business case, it's always what's most important. So can you repeat the question again? Because I know the first part.
Well, so Antonio, you know, we spoke about, you know, what you do is the sort of foundation level when you come in and you want to start a new computer vision project. You know, make sure that the business is bought in, make sure that you can set goals with the business and to annotation and data quality processes. So if we want to start looking at, you know, bringing in an algorithm, what do we look at next? Do we just go pick a use case or where does it take you?
Yeah, again, it's starting from the use case and seeing what the state of the art can achieve. Like, what can we do with the current available methods to solve this particular problem? So it starts with the use case, then checking the data quality, and then going into the algorithms. Usually, the diversity of methods that we can use reliably in deep learning, it's actually not that big. It's not that many architectures that are going to give you the best results. Is usually some of the big milestones, like the ResNet, like the UNet, like Mascar CNN, like these methods that have already been implemented by many other people. And usually just working them through a library is enough to solve a business problem, like using something like FastAI or Keras or, you know, these things that are already implemented. The detection model by Facebook for object detection, the thing is amazing. It has like so many object detection models already pre-trained that you're able to solve these business problems in a particular short amount of time. But the thing that's going to take you more, it's the data quality. That's where most of your work is going to go. That's where you're going to spend most time working on, ensuring that the data that you have is good enough to solve the business problem.
What was it? I think it was, I seen something on LinkedIn. It was something like software engineering, 10% writing code, 90% debugging code to see where the problem was. Then it was like machine learning, 1% writing code, 9% debugging and finding out where the code doesn't work, 90% doing data quality.
It's like that. It's totally like that.
Okay. So look, you can come in, you can show business value fast. I think that's kind of, that's what all the businesses want. And at the end of the day, look, no matter how technical you want to be, your role is to show business value. Once you start getting a bit of buy-in, you can start to take on more tasks. As long as you've already provided return on investment, they're probably not looking at you like this joker just wants to do a bit of research at their expense, you know. And there are, as you said, a lot of options out there to do sort of fast projects with some tools that are out there already.
Yeah, it's totally like that. Like so, we're not really hired to research. We're hired to solve business problems. The thing is that solving business problems usually entails an amount of research. So it's part of it.
True. So one thing that's really good about yourself, Antonio, is, you know, you're a mentor, you're a teacher. You mentioned your students, you're a data science mentor at Thinkful. You've mentored many students. You've actually connected me with a couple of those guys as well who have been looking for positions. As I said, you run meetup events. You're very much informed in that section of the industry. So from your opinion, actually, I also even forgot to mention, you've hired people at your company, The Chain.
Yeah.
So if you're if you're a computer vision engineer now, and they're looking to go and get out into the market, what would you tell them are the important skills to have or to be looking or otherwise upskilling all the time to be a computer vision engineer?
Oh, I think having a good understanding of algorithms and data structures and the fundamentals of Python, it's really, really important. Like understanding what's the runtime of your algorithms, it's something that actually it's very important for knowing which methods are you going to be able to use in production and which you're not going to be able to use in production. So things like what I was mentioning before, that I was working on key point matching because a previous data scientist at Home2Go had done some work based on key point matching. This thing was like completely unfeasible to deploy in production because of how expensive it was computationally. And these are things that people who, you know, don't have a background in algorithms and data structures find hard to understand. So having this intuition about which methods are going to be able to deploy fast, and which methods are you not going to be able to deploy fast because it's like too computationally intensive and, you know, it only works on a small data set, it's really important. So I advise my students to take the courses on algorithms and data structures that are on Coursera by this professor from Stanford, Tim Roughgarden. They are very, very good, and they give a very good intuition about which methods you can deploy in production and which you can't. So another thing that I advise my students to do when they want to move into computer vision, it's to have a public portfolio. put your things that you have done in computer vision into your GitHub and actually be able to talk about them and be able to explain exactly what problem were you trying to solve. And this is very important when going through the hiring process, because most people who are hiring don't have a technical background, and most people who are hiring are not working in the field themselves. So you should be able to tell the story about what was the problem that you were trying to solve and why did you do the choices that you did in order to solve. I advise my students to go into Python data structures and storytelling. And a very good resource for learning computer vision, one that I always recommend, is the Pi Image Search blog by Adrian Rosebrook. He has these amazing tutorials that are very detailed and very practical. And they are a very good way to get into the field. So this, I would say, are the most important things that you can do to get a job. Getting into Kaggle also helps quite a lot. I particularly have not done that because I have things on my GitHub portfolio that I can show. But showing that you understand how to solve a data science problem and being able to showcase your work, like people who publish kernels on Kaggle do, it's very valuable. So when I hire people, I usually ask them to explain code to me, to actually solve a particular problem, and then to explain to me how did they solve the problem, which choices did they make in their code. So this is a very good way to screen where people are able to explain their thought process. It's something that I find valuable when being working alongside somebody else. When somebody is able to explain code to me, I am able to critique it and I'm even able to continue the work if it's needed. So I think that's a very important skill to have.
Nice. Cool. Thanks for that. So I suppose I just wanted to ask you your thoughts on a couple of technologies then as well that have been trending for computer vision. We've already kind of touched on data annotation. Not necessarily a trend, that one, though. It's kind of a fundamental. But the data annotation engineer is a possible trend, for sure. One thing is, and you've probably experienced it as well, is the change in how computer vision can now be done with the introduction of edge devices. It's really changed in many aspects of it. You know, if you even look at autonomous driving, or most autonomous vehicles will now have something running on an edge device. Anything that goes into a surveillance camera, edge device. You know, it's kind of really at the core of it, you know. What do you think about edge devices? Where did they come from? And I suppose, what big impacts will they have?
Well, to be honest, I think they're going to move society into a direction that many people find worrying. And that is that we're going to have mass surveillance all the time. You know, this computer vision embedded into everything is something that will make surveillance pervasive. And we're going to get used to the idea of being watched all the time, you know, because these cameras and these computer vision devices are going to be so cheap that we're probably going to have cameras with object detection and facial recognition on every street. And this is something that people need to be aware of. And I think that the reduction of the cost of these devices is going to bring like some very interesting questions for society. Like, where do we want to be in the next 10 or 20 years?
You know, there's a funny trend to that, and it's come up on a lot of the podcasts, is the reason why cameras have actually gotten so cheap is social media, because people are demanding new phones quicker than ever. And you put them on technologies on a scale, and you look at smartphones in terms of, you know, technology advancements versus any other technology available. It's after, you know, it's 10, 20 times more advanced than it was every like 2 or 3 years, you know, it's coming through. And what one big part of a smartphone now is, of course, a camera. So you can get a really, really strong camera for really cheap.
That turns everybody into a content producer. So
maybe it's not even that social media is the problem, because if we're talking on us already being surveillanced, social media, and you know, that's checking everything we do already. It's building our personalities.
Think about it. It's different. What you put in social media is what you choose to share. What you get from surveillance, it's simply what's exposed, what's happening out there. So
I don't know if it happened in Germany, but on the Irish contact tracing app, it didn't even save personal information. What it done is it saved your phone's GPS location, and people refused to download it because they felt like there was rumors. Oh, it's going to tell your job that you have COVID. It's going to tell your job everything. It's going to tell everything about what you do. And then people were then going writing and complaining about it on Facebook, where they're probably getting ads directly related from their last Google search sent straight to their homepage. Being like, yeah, the people with the contact tracing app are tracking what I do, but that's it. No one else.
But yeah, you see, it's an open question. Like what are people comfortable to share? And people should be mindful about this, because it's as you said, it's like Google already knows everything that these people have searched. You know, every embarrassing thing that they have searched, it's something that Google knows, right? But then they cannot share data with the government about COVID, which is something that, you know, impacts us all. It's odd, you know? So what I'm saying is, not that surveillance is necessarily a bad thing, but it's something that we need to think about how we do it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know from speaking with other companies, it wasn't so much facial recognition, but they can almost do human tracking by it wouldn't scan your biometrics and it wouldn't store them. But it would almost basically make you a number or a QR code. So it would track you on your destination and say, you're not Anthony. Your QR code number 1012, and it would track me across the city till I get to my destination. Yeah. So it's GDPR compliant, but it's also still tracking me everywhere I go.
Yeah, yeah. The thing is that we're moving into a more transparent society. I think that's good. The thing is that we need to think about how we handle concerns about privacy that are reasonable. So this technology called differential privacy that has been coming up in the last years is something that I think we'll find many use cases for us who want to do machine learning on publicly available data while protecting the privacy of people who choose to share their data. And in some cases, it shouldn't even be a choice, because suppose that you have a public street, you know, and there is a car crash, you know, and maybe there's a hit and run. You want to identify who did this. You know, this is not a place for real privacy. This is not a place where you can say, oh no, this person who took did a hit and run should be able to protect his or her privacy. It's the public arena. It's the public sphere. You know, it's different than what you do at your own home, or, you know, if something innocuous happens, it's different.
I am 100% in agreement with that use of surveillance, personally. But it also kind of takes me to the next one, and it's quite trending as well: federated learning in computer vision. Now, if you were to do something like federated learning in a situation like that, where someone done a hit and run, federated learning could quickly, you know, run again on everything in the image that it doesn't want to focus on, and you can only take the driver out of the image if you want. That's the capabilities that it actually has. Now, I've yet to see it running as successfully. I think we will see it soon in the future. But what do you think on federated learning? Do you think it will come into surveillance? Do you think it will come into other computer vision, I suppose not even industries, but domains?
I haven't worked with federated learning hands-on yet. I have read a couple of articles mentioning how it will come into play as part of machine learning with privacy considerations, but I cannot really comment anything substantial on this?
I do think, as I said, like yourself, I've read a lot about it, but I've not seen anyone actually doing it. I don't think, but there's companies out there now who are selling solutions that can make your black box a white box, and they provide a federated learning solution that you can then just buy and bring into your business so that you can use your algorithms.
I know that, I think the company from Andrew Trask in Oxford, these people are doing both federated learning and differential privacy, but I have not
been... Is that Zane, is it?
I don't remember the name. I know that his PyTorch packages for federated learning are very popular. And, you know, if you go to, you know, job positions, you will find like people being hired to work with federated learning. Like recently, it's like something that has come up. I found it interesting, but as I say, I don't have any firsthand experience working with it.
Yeah. No, look, it's. I think, as I said, it's more trending than it is, and it's more for one for the future. But look, I think that's us for time, Antonio. So everyone listening, this is the SODA AI Computer Vision and Production Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly. Today's guest is Antonio Rueda-Fuisen. Great to have you on the show, Antonio.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Computer Vision in Production Podcast with your host, Anthony Kelly. To make sure you get updates on the latest episodes of the show, make sure you subscribe on your preferred podcast listening app or add me on LinkedIn.